I think this quote sums it up. If you're over 25 and still trying to fix weaknesses, that ship has sailed.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. Welcome to 2019, everybody. I thought this was a perfect time to post a conversation I had a while back with John Coyle. I've been waiting the perfect time for this, and I think this is probably it. John is the founder of The Art of Really Living, and he's one of the world's leading experts in innovation and design thinking. He's an author, an Olympic silver medalist, so I'm pretty excited that I actually know one of those. He's been an NBC sports analyst, and he's been a professor of innovation. So he's basically done just about everything. And he's been applying design thinking to companies' careers, lives, and leadership challenges for over 20 years now. So I really wanted to get him on the show to have a wide-ranging and, since you know me, occasionally off-topic conversation. So without further ado, let's jump right in. Welcome to Future Proof.
Thank you, Jeremy. It's good to be here.
So I know that there's a lot in your background. I could go a whole episode on the really interesting trajectory you've had, but kind of like in a nutshell, high level, what can you tell us about kind of how you, like the most interesting things that you've done, which I know you're going to touch on, to where you are today? Was it 94 where you were a member of the relay team that won the silver?
Correct. Yes. Yeah. So I'll actually continue the other story and just say how that happened, because it's actually through David Kelly and design thinking, and this is the only reason I really have a medal, as it turns out. So I was, when I was a senior at Stanford, I managed to get 12th place in the world in speed skating, despite being in California with no coach and no ice time. So when I graduated and joined the Olympic team full time, I was reasonably certain that I had a good shot of going from 12th to 6th to 1st. But what actually happened is they put me in a program to fix my weaknesses, and it didn't work. And I went from 12th in the world to 34th the next year to not even making the team 2 years later, skating slower than I had 10 years prior, the first time I made the team at 13. So at this point is where design thinking kicked back in. I decided to back up, evaluate the problem from a different angle, and ultimately decided to quit the team, not the sport, and solve a different problem. Rather than fix my weaknesses, I decided to solve for how do I leverage my strengths. And I trained all my own for another year all by myself, and a year to the day of getting about 30th at trials and being way off the pace. My very first race back at the U.S. trials a year later, I set a U.S. record by 5 seconds and skated faster than the world record by over a second.
I mean, that's insane. I love it. And I feel like, obviously, so I should tell you, I'm sitting right next to your book right now. And, you know, I loved it. I thought, I mean, that experience that you had to be so formative in the impetus for writing this book many years later, just because, you know, like, you really can't just try to, like, you can mitigate your weaknesses, you can design around them, but you can't just say my goal in life is to not suck at anything. I feel like you have to kind of stand out at one or two things. No,
absolutely agree. I mean, we are wired from childhood to play whack-a-mole with our weaknesses, and for good reason. I mean, I think most people, particularly high achievers, are wired to never quit things, because as kids, we'll quit anything easily, and so we get trained to not do so. But that same good advice for kids, I think, goes off the rails for adults, and a lot of high-achieving people just will never quit. And they get stuck doing tasks, activities, jobs, careers, where they're actually not doing the thing that could make them feel self-actualized or bring them happiness, and they get stuck. And I think the core line of inquiry and answer in the book is around how do you get unstuck, and how do you look at your life, your career, your team through a different lens and find new ways to solve old problems. So that's really what the book is all about, is being able to do that.
I want to ask you like a quick lightning round of semi less important, irreverent things. All right, cool. All right, first off, given that you've, interacted with the infamous Tanya Harding a little, how good was Margot Robbie in I, Tanya, performance-wise?
So Margot was perfect. Tanya and I were in the same games. And, just to shed a little light on my interactions with Tanya, the first time I met Tanya Harding, she was naked and so was I.
That's really, you know what? This is a totally NSFW podcast, so you can share the rest of the story.
Okay. Actually, it's not so politically incorrect as it turns out. I was in the Olympic Village, and you know, of course, the story was all over the news newswires. But I was in getting a massage, and the procedure in the physical sports therapy room was: you walk in, you take off your clothes, you put on a towel, you walk out to a massage bed. Somebody magically appears to give you a massage, and I was alone at first, even though there was probably 40, 50 beds in the room. And the TV was on right in front of me. There were TVs attached to each two beds. And a little while later, I heard some rustling, and I flipped over, and I saw a blonde bob of hair, but I still didn't know who it was. And right then, there was an announcement on the TV, breaking news in the Tonya Harding, Jeff Galluli affairs. Appears Tonya may have had a role. And right then, our heads swiveled, our eyes locked. I was embarrassed. I felt like I was intruding on her nightmare. So I was about to turn my head and pretend I hadn't seen her. And she literally reached over, grabbed my arm, and said, no, turn that up. Turn that up. I want to hear this. No shame.
Wow. I mean, that is impressive, I was going to say. And especially the way that story starts, you're like, I think it's going to go in a different way, but still pretty much lives up to expectations. So, okay, another question. I've heard you're a chili pepper fan, not of the music, but like the actual hot peppers. Do you have a favorite kind that you recommend?
The yellow Moruga scorpion pepper is, in my book, the single greatest flavor on the planet. This is the thing. It's super hot. Yes, of course. But think about a green pepper. It's not hot and it has almost no flavor. You move up to jalapeno, it's got a decent amount of flavor and a decent amount of heat. You move up to habanero, lots of flavor, lots of heat, and it just keeps going. And so the yellow Trinidad Moruga is crazy hot. We're talking 1.5 million Scovilles, but the flavor is even stronger than the heat. So if you can manage to dose it out properly, it to me is like salt. Like, can you imagine a world without salt and then you suddenly discover salt? Well, same thing for yellow Moruga scorpion pepper.
Okay, cool. I got to remember that. I was just speaking in New Orleans and I bought some, I don't know what kind of hot sauce it was, but they had me sign a waiver and I was like, well, this is going to be pretty good. So, okay. And last thing is, so I know that you've served kind of alongside or consulted for Enron back in the day. You're one of the good guys, but you've served alongside Jeff Skilling and Ken Lay, as well as Lance Armstrong, from a cycling perspective, right? So would you rather engage in competitive cycling alongside Jeff Skilling or work for energy CEO Lance Armstrong?
Oh my God. Well, honestly, they're the same person. I mean, these two guys have the same mannerisms, that sort of icy hawk-like stare, that really highly ego-driven approach, the sort of deep down belief that they're superior to you, they talk down to you. But they're also incredibly innovative, just without that little lens of ethics or morals. So honestly, I think it would be the same thing. These two guys are the same person.
Oh, okay. All right. That's fair. Can you even define, for people who haven't heard of design thinking or know as much about it, what it is and what it isn't? Because it's very hot right now, but every now and then I do run into people who don't quite know what it is or how to wrap their heads around it. That might be helpful.
Sure. I mean, design thinking is really two things. It's a process that has steps. They're iterative and cyclical, so that, you know, there's an order, but they don't really matter. And then they're sitting behind it is a mindset. And I think that the mindset piece is as important, if not more. And, you know, from a process standpoint, is first, you know, acceptance. You have to accept you have a problem before you can actually solve it. That sounds obvious, but it's not always true for lots of people. Then you have to actually define the problem. What is it? And this is the step you always circle back to. Are we defining the right problem? Are we solving the right problem? You can have all the right questions to the wrong. You can have all the right answers to the wrong question, and it doesn't matter. Empathize is the third step, and again, these are cyclical. But do you understand the problem from the lens of the person or thing you're solving for? If you're solving somebody else's problem through your lens, well, you're solving your problem, not theirs. And then, you know, the sort of typical steps after that are generate ideas, ideate, test, prototype, and then test. So ideate, prototype, test. That's design thinking as a process, but process is useless without the right mindsets. And that's where I think design thinking is a really amazing tool. It is really two things. It is hyper focus on solving a problem, which most great problem solvers have, but it is also a detached, analytical, scientific perspective of the problem. Most people tend to get anchored to one solution. These are Occam's razor, right? The simplest solution to any given problem is probably the right one, except when it's not. And so what design thinking, I think, gives as a mindset is this ability to back up, look at a problem from a distance, look at all the possible permutations, and then start selecting a human-centric solution that will perhaps break previous barriers and finally lead to success. So that's design thinking in a nutshell.
Why do you think it's so hot these days? Why is it something that people are getting, starting to wrap their heads around and starting to see that it has tremendous value as people are trying to determine really what the best strategies are, for the future?
You know, one hypothesis is that all the easy problems have been solved. So here's just a, from a neuropsychological standpoint, when you get hyper-focused on something, when you're emotionally engaged in solving a problem, one of the unfortunate side effects is you get a narrow view, you get a narrow perspective, and that is actually detrimental to solving complex problems. So I think the reason the design thinking is becoming the rage is this ability to back up and get that detached analytical perspective to frame the problem properly. When you can do that, you can finally break through on what appear to be, nearly impossible or intransigent problems. Like, let's face it, when I was at the Olympic Training Center, by all perspectives, I had no rights to ever make an Olympic team. By the tests I took, I was a poor athlete. But those tests were testing for a certain kind of athlete. And as soon as I opened up the window that, hey, maybe a different kind of athlete can still be successful, maybe I can change my approach and skate a different track than everybody else, suddenly, I didn't lead to incremental improvement. It led to massive breakthrough. And I think companies are seeing the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think also in a lot of ways, I kind of liken it to as new technologies show up in the marketplace, sometimes you can say, well, AR shows up, let's just try to use augmented reality in some way, shape, or form in our marketing, but maybe it's actually there to solve a different problem for you, and you have to sometimes get creative. And likewise, also, you shouldn't, I don't think, be trying to dictate what technology solves what problem. You have to be really kind of problem solver first, technologist second. In my case, I know that's a little bit more my wheelhouse, but that's just my perspective.
No, I think you're dead on. And it reminds me of one of my first lectures in the field of design thinking. It was actually Brendan Boyle, Dennis Boyle's brother. These are Stanford guys that were in the early days of design thinking. He came in and he's standing in front of the room all professorial, and then suddenly he puts his arms at his sides and he starts jumping up and down. And he looked like a crazy person. And then he actually jumped all the way around the room with his hands at his sides. And we're all looking at each other going, what is going on? But that's when he brought it back to this idea you're talking about. He said, he got all professorial again. And then he said, our first problem involves springs, a technology, right? If you don't understand what it's like to be a spring, you can't know how to use a spring to solve a problem. So that empathy piece, same thing with AR, right? If you don't understand it from the inside out, what problems it can solve and what it can't, then you're just going to sort of layer it on a bunch of stuff like tape, and it may not stick.
Yeah. So, I mean, one thing that did stick with me, see what I did there, was the book. For me, the biggest takeaway was, I think, the fourth rule of design thinking. Let me know if I get the numbers wrong, but design for strengths and design around weaknesses. Don't just try to fix them. So if I got that wrong, let me know. But assuming that that's right, why do you think that is so important ultimately?
No, you nailed it. And it is something that most adults don't do. Most adults that I know continue to play whack-a-mole with weaknesses, and that is the wrong use of your energies, because true weaknesses are not solvable. There's a difference between a skill gap and a weakness. Skill gaps are things we do all the time. You get a new operating system, whatever, you learn some new skill. Weaknesses are fundamental things with us that you can't really change. And one of the lessons in the book is that weaknesses and strengths tend to be facets of the same thing. Our strengths are often also our weakness, and vice versa. Being a strong anaerobic athlete, which I am, good sprinter, means I am necessarily a poor aerobic athlete, endurance athlete, which I am also. Now here's the rub, and here's the thing that's I think explained very clearly repeatedly in the book, is if you fix a weakness rather than design around it, we'll talk about that in a second. If you fix a weakness, you run the risk of destroying the corresponding strength. When the Olympic team trained me to fix my aerobic weakness, I got no better at the aerobic activities, but I got a lot worse at the sprints. If you are a direct, honest person, you're probably also blunt and rude. If you try to fix being blunt and rude, you run the risk of destroying your strength of being direct and honest. And that's how bad ideas are born. Nobody raises their hand and says, does anybody besides me think this is a bad idea? If you're detail oriented, you're probably a perfectionist. If you're a big picture strategy person, you're probably not good with details. If you are a creative person, you're probably disorganized. And so on and so on and so on. And the day you can sort of let go and say, you know what, I'm a creative person. I am not a detail-oriented, meticulous person. That's the day you can double down on the things you're best at, and life gets a hell of a lot better.
So, I mean, why do you think people are taught to just shore up their weaknesses, or at least never be able to allow themselves, give themselves the permission to suck at a few things? Because I've always thought, give yourself permission to, as an organization, even say that we're going to be weak in a few areas, which then allows you the bandwidth in order to succeed in a few spots.
You got it. I think actually it's operant conditioning. I think we've been trained this way since kids, and it just never lets go. Because it's important as kids to not give up too soon, to sort of suck it up in the short term for greater rewards. But at some point, if you're delaying gratification and just trying to face down a weakness for years, decades, that's what Thoreau calls a life of quiet desperation. It is not at all a self-actualized life. And unfortunately, we program that way. And I think this quote sums it up. If you're over 25 and still trying to fix weaknesses, that ship has sailed. So instead, how do you design around? Well, like you said, one of the easiest ways to design around is to simply admit it. The day I let go, I was a PMO, for God's sakes, for Goldman Sachs in New York, for Y2K. There was no worse job for me and my skill set on the planet. I sucked it up and I did it for a year, and we successfully, converted to 00001, but it was a terrible use of my strengths and skills. And the day I finally went to my boss, I said, you know what, this really is probably not for me. I'm more of a creative type. Can you get me on a marketing project? Well, that's when I went to work for Enron. It was a much better fit. So the ability to sort of quit something you're doing to pursue something better. Yeah, I mean, you don't have to always openly admit to everybody that you're bad at something, but a simpler way is to simply say, I'm probably more of a creative strategic innovator than I am a detail-oriented project manager. That's one way to frame it.
How do you, just in general, you've had a pretty productive career thus far? Not that you're closer to the beginning of it than the end, probably, but how do you kind of stay productive? Do you have any type of, like, let's say, morning routine that saves you time during the course of the rest of your week or anything along those lines?
Well, I have to say I'm a big fan of bulletproof coffee. The intersection of healthy brain fats and caffeine gets me started pretty much every day. And when I travel and I forget to bring my MCT oil, I am less productive. But for those that don't know, that's just simply mixing coffee with MCT oil, which is a form of coconut oil, which used to be considered poison and somehow in the last 10 years is now considered, the greatest thing in the world for you to consume.
Everything's cyclical, right? Yeah. In a few years, we're all going to be like, it turns out heroin is good for you.
Right. I'm starting to think that we don't know anything about anything. I mean, for God's sakes, I ate margarine for 20 years. Trans fats. Anyways, the other things that I do is I'm an invert in terms of what everybody says you should be doing. I do all of my emails and tactical stuff during the day, and then I do all my creative work after dinner, which is supposedly not the right order, but that just works for me. I'm kind of a night person, so I can't seem to focus during the day. If I have a bunch of whack-a-mole tasks sitting in front of me, I can't get creative and write books and create new TED Talks and so forth unless I've sort of plugged a bunch of the leaky holes in my day in terms of follow-ups and things I'm supposed to be following through on.
Yeah, I want to ask you actually about the TED Talk, because I think that's maybe even how I possibly initially connected with you. I'm trying to remember, but I know it was, I feel like the talk I saw was maybe like a year or two ago even. It was maybe the Naperville one, but is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, cool. So tell us a little bit about that, and then I have a kind of follow-up question.
Well, there's two. So I'm suspecting the one you saw, it was the one around time.
Yes.
So, and that's the book I'm working on now. It should be out sometime next year. But this is my ultimate fascination, really, is just how we as humans perceive time. The technical term is chronoception, and very specifically, this my obsession sort of comes from this feeling that I started getting as an adult that time was speeding up, that summers didn't last as long as they used to. And so I've done some formal and informal polling, and it turns out a vast majority of adults feel that time is accelerating, that summers feel shorter than they used to. And very specifically, I've asked audiences all over the world, how long did summers last as a kid? And the ubiquitous favorite word is forever. So how is that fair that time isn't just shorter, that it's actively getting shorter? And so I've decided to do something about it and research and talk to every expert I could around the world around how do we process time, and very more specifically, how do we prescriptively unwind this acceleration and instead slow, expand, and stop that acceleration and experience summers longer than when we were kids. And I'm happy to share with you that I have figured out exactly how to do that. And I'm about, I don't know, 10 years into this year already.
I mean, for me, at the very least, this is a topic I've been really obsessed with in a lot of ways. I kind of feel that I'm always trying to anticipate what the next few years looks like. And if the next few years essentially gets here faster, well, then I don't have enough time to actually figure out what those years are going to look like from a marketing, technology, communications perspective. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And you know, I think a large swath of the working world experiences time poverty, right? In vast majority, virtually every person, and when I do my talks, when I ask them, you know, who here has enough time, nobody raises their hand, like nobody. And that's, I mean, if our most valuable currency, our most valuable commodity in life is time, and we all have time poverty, how is that okay? That's just, it's totally unacceptable. Just like we wouldn't and don't accept that, you know, world hunger should be, why should we accept that time poverty is ubiquitous and okay? It's not.
When you're trying to create the future or invent the future in some way as an entrepreneur, as an executive, it's so important to be able to be persuasive and not just right. So what for you is the secret to that? What can people take away and say, you know what, if I can do A, B, or C right from a even public speaking or even privately when you're pitching to a client or, you know, to a boss, just to get your point across better, what's the best way to improve on that metric?
You know, I'll tell you, I think storytelling is at the core. It's such an overused word these days, but, you know, the history of the human being, I think up until the invention of writing, which is relatively recent, was all oral tradition. And I think our brains just became wired for the construct of a story. And very specifically, we know the hero's journey and then seven or five or however many steps you decide to accept from Joseph Campbell, that form of storytelling really, really sticks. People will remember it. They won't remember the facts. They won't remember the data, but they'll remember a story. And so all of my talks and throughout the book, I use narrative to share the examples. And I, you know, I think what I'm really just sort of lucky in terms of the book is, you know, Patrick Lencioni has written a bunch of books using sort of parables to illuminate, you know, great leadership principles like the five dysfunctions of the team, for example. I just happen to be lucky that my parable is true. So I think storytelling is one of the most powerful tools you can have to sway an audience, because they will listen, they will pay attention, and if they follow the tea leaves of the story, they will actually come to similar conclusions that you're hoping they do.
That actually just kind of gets me thinking. Sometimes when you're working in a team, you might be entirely wrong in your prediction about where you should be spending your time as a brand or what technology is to invest in. When that happens, do you think it makes sense to conduct a post-mortem to figure out why you got things wrong and why you spent your time in the wrong places? And you know, if so, how do you even go about conducting something like that?
I mean, I think absolutely postmortem is really, really important. And I think the way the Blue Angels do it, which I've co-opted, is such the right way. So I don't know if you've heard of the way they do it, but they call it an after-action review. And it all starts with, here's what I did wrong. And you just go around the room with, here's how I screwed up, here's the wrong decisions I made, here's the assumptions I made that weren't true. And you go around the room till everybody runs out. And the beauty of this is all introspective. It's all me, what I did. It's nobody pointing fingers. And then and only then does the room then get to, hey, Bob, hey, Sue, hey, Steve, hey, boss, here's one other thing I think we missed. And if you do the first round right, there's actually nothing left because everybody will have self-identified all the things that went wrong and they did it for themselves. So nobody's pointing fingers, nobody's blaming. And that leaves the room refreshed and ready to tackle a new thing and just aware that failure is part of success, right? That taking risks is inherent in innovation and it's never going to be perfect. But if you don't take the big risks, you're never going to get the big rewards.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder if there are even any studies, I'm just thinking out loud, about companies that are better predictors and are investing their dollars in the things that wind up being bigger over the next few years, if one of the traits that that they have is that they don't point fingers and that you're allowed to be wrong, because it just seems to me that if you do point fingers at the end of that type of process, when things don't go perfectly, then it stops people from saying what they're less likely to speak up in the first place if they're afraid of being admonished after the fact.
Oh, that's 100% true. And I'll give just two data points here. Number one, the book Culture Code by my friend, but no relation, Daniel Coyle, you know, one of the three precepts. He's just studied great teams all over the planet in all forms, be it from, technology companies to sports teams to music groups. He studied their core characteristics. And the number one was safety, that I feel safe to express myself, to take risks, to fail and not be blamed. The other thing that we know from relatively new neuroscience is published by Judith Glaser in her book, Conversational Intelligence, is that when you judge the idea of somebody in the room that's at a peer level or lower, and the most common form of this, by the way, is, oh, we've tried that before, which may be the single worst phrase uttered in any conference room in the world. What happens is the idea generator gets shut down. Specifically, they go a little bit into fight-flight mode. They emit cortisol and catecholamine, which causes a narrowing of focus, the diminishment of their cranial capacity, and very specifically, the inability to be creative. So you actually make them dumber, and you make them dumber in a specific way, less creative, which is the single worst thing in the world to do if you're actually trying to generate ideas. So judging the ideas of those in the room is an incredible breach of safety. You have to separate the generation of ideas from the judgment. And the simple way to do that is just time box it. We're going to generate ideas first, and in 10 minutes, we're going to evaluate them.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways, that's the whole problem with innovation, is that you have just a lot of people who are, you know, poo-pooing ideas before they're ever encouraged to say those ideas, champion those ideas in the first place. So you've been really good at thinking outside the box and just challenging the status quo throughout your career in so many different ways. So what's a brutal truth you think that organizations just don't understand about innovation?
Vast majority of Fortune 500 CEOs, I think it was 95%, say that the primary barrier to innovation is not the usual suspects. It's not resources. It's not budget. It's not mindset so much or ideas. It's actually culture. And culture is created by leadership. And when you create a closed culture where people feel judged and are not willing to share their ideas, that's when you become blockbuster and you go out of business. I think the openness to be curious to ideas, particularly bad ones, is a core capacity that great firms have. I can remember having some bosses, my great leaders that I had, I can remember embarrassingly bringing them some terrible ideas where they should have said, really? You really think that's a good idea? And instead they said, I'm curious about this, John. Have you checked with any of the other team members to see what their thoughts are, or with legal or with marketing or sales or IT? And then I go and I find out this is a completely ludicrous idea and I'm embarrassed. But the back of my mind, I know this one thing. I know that my boss is open to my ideas. And that same one thing is the number one reason people leave companies. People leave, they join companies and leave managers. The number one reason they leave managers is because my boss is not open to my ideas. So it's a huge cancer that companies need to fix.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you mentioned the idea of have you run it past marketing or legal, or even the fact that you run it past the bosses, because with respect to wisdom of the crowd, aggregate forecasts, they've been proven to be better than individual ones, you know, like 15 to 20 60% better, to be precise. So I've always found this to be very fascinating, because if we know that this is true, why don't we, or, you know, not necessarily you and I, but just as society, why don't we run our businesses that way?
You know, from my experience sitting in the hallways and the cubicles, one of the main barriers is time. We get back to the time thing is, I'm under time pressure. I don't feel like I have time to go canvas the group for their perspectives on how we're going to solve this problem. And so I just declare what we're going to do. And that's fine sometimes. I mean, everybody's forgiving of a leader that says, hey, given the time pressure and the available facts and data, here's the direction I'm setting. They're totally cool with that. But if you do that every time, that's when you shut down teams and nobody brings ideas anymore. And that's when, you know, you kill the innovation spirit. And I think, you know, that's my experience, is that really one of the major culprits is time.
Oh, kind of depressing. I mean, but speaking of time, I mean, I know we're about out. So, John, thank you so much for making the time, and we'll talk to you soon.
Awesome. Thanks for having me on, Jeremy.
And thank you so much, John, again, for joining us. And thank you all for staying with us during our brief hiatus in Q4. Just a reminder, you can rate and review us. Be sure to subscribe if you haven't already. And frankly, if you haven't subscribed, come on, guys, you know, get it with the program. But we look forward to many more really great conversations, really great episodes with amazing thought leaders in all things future related over the next year. And we just want to make sure that you're along for the ride. So until next time, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof.